I remember having this moment of like, wait, hold on a second. You're telling me that I can make a living talking to people all day? Like, I'm sold. Like, that's my dream job.
The new school. This is The New School with your host, Christine Hong. Welcome to a new kind of school, where we talk about career paths you don't normally get to hear about in the classroom. Every episode, I talk to someone with an interesting life path and learn about how they got to where they are today.
Hey folks, thanks for joining us. Welcome to another episode of The New School Podcast with me, Christine Hong. As a fellow Asian American woman, I found the childhood ambition of our guest today totally resonated with me. When Dr. Therese Moscato was little, she wanted to be a doctor or the first female president. Well, neither of those goals worked out exactly, but safe to say that Therese has definitely found her calling. Once she realized psychology was a thing and that she could talk to people for a living, there was no turning back. In this brilliant conversation, Therese breaks down exactly how to become a licensed clinical psychologist, the qualities that make for an excellent therapist, and why self-care is crucial. Therese is a total pioneer. She was doing online therapy long before anyone else, and she built her Instagram following at a time when hardly any mental health professionals were on social media. She shares how she learned to face the fear of being on the cutting edge and trust her intuition. I just know you're going to love this conversation with her.
Really curious, actually. What did you want to be when you were growing up?
I was like your very typical Filipina daughter. I totally thought I wanted to be a doctor growing up. I know, it's just such a shocker. When I went to school, I was up until all the way through university, I thought I was pre-med, and then things kind of changed there and I took a different path. But for most of my life, I thought I wanted to be a doctor or the first female president of the United States. So I had no ambition at all.
I totally relate. Until I realized like, getting into politics is like the worst thing ever in this day and age. People just tear you apart.
That's kind of what I learned. I went to a pretty politically involved school, UC Berkeley. And as I got involved in politics there, basically I just found that I didn't think it was my lane for making a difference in the world. And I knew I wanted to make a big difference, but I thought I would do it in a different way.
So you knew you wanted to make a big difference on the world. And first you wanted to be a doctor. So how did you end up landing on psychology?
So when I was at Berkeley, I was taking all sorts of classes to fulfill my undergrad. I took a Psych 101 class and I was just loving the material. I just loved learning everything about human behavior and the human mind. And, you know, growing up in the culture I did as a Filipina American in Southern California, you know, mental health is not really part of the everyday conversation that we grow up with. And so I had no idea at all that there was a whole field of mental health and that therapy was this amazing life-giving thing. So I really encountered it and learned about it in that course. And I remember having this moment of like, wait, hold on a second. You're telling me that I can make a living talking to people all day? Like, I'm sold. Like, that's my dream job. So Shortly thereafter, I switched up my major, went from pre-med to psychology and mass communications. And it was psychology ever since.
Wow. Okay. That's awesome. Yeah. I'm trying to think, is there any other job where you can just talk to people, make a living? I'm like, talk show host. Perfect job for you. So you're like, I'm going to become a psychologist. What do you do next?
So I went to grad school. I went to the California School of Professional Psychology. I felt like the CSPP program had so much more of the stuff that mattered to me.
If you want to become a clinical psychologist, do you have to go to grad school?
To be a psychologist, you do. So you have to do your 4 years of undergrad, and then you typically will either want to get a PhD, which is the Doctor of Philosophy, or the PsyD, which is the Doctor of Psychology. The PsyD is the program that I took. And the reason I picked that one is because there's an emphasis in clinical practice, whereas PhDs often focus on the research part. So my program was a 4-year program. After 2 years of it, I got a master's. And then after 2 more years, I got the PsyD.
Nice. So do they even care how many psychology courses you've taken in college?
I think you have to do like the minimum. Truthfully, I think the academic experience comes secondary. I think when you go to grad school, you're learning things like how to manage boundaries with your clients, how to be an active listener, you know, interviewing your clients, asking questions. You're learning about family systems and psychodynamic theory and cognitive behavioral psychology. So these are things where you wouldn't have necessarily learned them in undergrad. I think they're looking for people who have the substance to be able to apply these things in the real world as they're working with their clients. And then the other part is grad school isn't just classes, right? So we're doing internships and really getting hands-on experience, seeing clients as interns. And it's super scary, but very necessary to be good at the job.
Yeah. What were those internships like in school?
Well, imagine that you've read 5 books on psychology and then you get thrust into a room playing the role of a therapist intern with someone for the first time. It is petrifying. I will never forget my first client. Obviously, I can't give any information about them, but I remember shaking in the room because you have such a need to want to like be helpful and you feel like you need to be the expert. And the funny thing is, seasoned therapists know that you don't have to be an expert, that most of the value of therapy is actually in just being present with a person, being able to help them feel seen and heard. And yeah, we'll do interventions and offer tools and resources, but your presence and your compassion is, gosh, maybe 80% of the value that you bring to your clients.
Is there a biggest surprise about the field, or like biggest thing you felt like you learned during your time there?
That you don't have to know everything. Just as a perfectionist, I really believed that I had to know everything and that, you know, if I read enough books or if I stressed out enough, that it would make me a better therapist. And I think it was so freeing to realize that that's actually the last thing that you need, is to know everything. And to realize that just in being the person that you are, being a human being in a room with another human and listening to their story, that is the most powerful thing that you can bring. And everything else is just icing on the cake. Great. But none of that matters. None of the knowledge that you have, none of the learning that you have matters if you're not present with them and if you can't be compassionate and empathic with them.
For an audience member who's looking for a therapist right now, do you have any suggestions on how they should look?
Absolutely. The first thing I would say is have a little bit of patience, because shopping for a therapist is not like picking up, you know, something from the grocery store that you know what you want. There's a little bit of a process involved. So my suggestion is do a little bit of searching, set aside a couple of hours, and narrow down your list to say 3 to 5 therapists who you think might be a good fit for you by looking at their website, watching their videos or their social media, just getting a feel for them. And then ideally, you want to meet with or call 2 of them. And when you speak with them is when you're really going to get a sense for who they are and how they feel with you. If you feel comfortable with them, that's a great indicator. And if anything in your intuition is saying, oh, I don't know, then listen to that. Don't force it. It's worth taking the time to find a therapist that you feel like you really connect with.
Yeah. So when you were leaving school and about to start your first real job, how did you decide what you wanted to focus on in the field of psychology?
I graduated from my grad program in 2008, which some people may know as like the beginning of a major recession in the USA or in the world, actually. I was really fortunate. I was already working in one of my internships at a community college as a learning disability specialist, which means that I was providing assessments to folks to see if they might have a learning disability so they could get special accommodations at school to help equal the playing field and help them learn. It was a really fantastic job. I was already doing it part-time as a student. And so it was a really easy transition for me. When I graduated, I basically had a job in that field already. It wasn't until later that I decided to kind of test out my life in private practice and, you know, do the things that took me on the path to where I am today.
So after you graduate, are you a licensed psychologist or do you need to take an exam?
When I was a learning disability specialist, I had a special certification for that that didn't require me to be a licensed psychologist. When I decided to obviously practice, I did need to get licensed so that I could practice under my own license instead of working as a psychological assistant under someone else's license. And the reason you want to do that is because when you work under someone else's license, you're splitting all of your income with them. And when you work for yourself, you get to keep it all. So I took a horrible test called the ECCP. And the ECCP is like the board for medical school. It's like the most stressful exam. The ECCP is so stressful and so hard that most people take like an intensive course just to learn how to prepare for the exam. Just to give you an example of how stressed out I was about this exam, I think 2 weeks before my test date, my jaw completely froze, like it locked to where I could barely open my mouth. And I saw an acupuncturist, a massage therapist, I saw everyone I could trying to loosen the muscles that were in my jaw, thinking that there was something wrong. Well, I had my test as scheduled. And when I walked out of my test, guess what happened? Jaw completely unlocks. I'm totally fine. So I think all the tension of preparing for this exam that was like such a big deal to become a licensed therapist, it was just weighing on me. And oh man, I was so stressed out. But luckily it went away after I took the test. And luckily for me, I passed the first time.
So I noticed you focus on remote workers now. Is that your original focus right after you became licensed?
No, not right after I became licensed. So I had kind of a generalized practice and would see all sorts of folks, but usually folks who were dealing with anxiety and depression in some way, shape, or form. About 5 years ago, I had like this moment where I decided to focus on creating a remote practice for myself. And at the time, there weren't really a lot of therapists doing this type of thing, but I basically had no choice. For those of you who are like in the Southern California area, I was commuting 4 hours a day sometimes. So like 2 hours each way. It was a nightmare. It was the most awful experience. For anyone that's been in traffic, they feel me right now. So I think they might understand. But you can imagine like being in a car for 4 hours a day, you're waking up at the crack of dawn, you're driving and it's hard on your back and it's exhausting and you get home and it's dark. So I just had like a breaking point where I was like, I can't keep doing this. I'm exhausted. And so I experimented with doing a little bit of online therapy. And essentially, I loved it so much that I decided to pivot my practice to see clients 100% online. It wasn't necessarily easy at first. A lot of clients were a bit unsure about seeing their therapist online. And it's kind of funny talking about this now, right? Because now it's what everybody's doing. But at the time, it was kind of edgy and it wasn't really mainstream. So I converted my whole practice into a 100% online practice and then decided to take my practice on the road. I can live anywhere in the world and continue to do the work that I do. I hated that I had that limitation on my vacation days. And as a therapist, I didn't get vacation days paid for because, you know, a lot of times I was working for myself. So long story short, I got to travel the world, enjoy vacationing without having to ever stop working. And because of that, I decided to really focus as well on other folks who are working remotely, just like I was.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, I can only imagine because people are like, oh, I'm supposed to lie on a couch in your room. And now we're on a video call.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you'd be surprised. I think a lot of people think in their head that online therapy might feel weird or awkward, but at the end of the day, my clients really love it for the most part because it's extremely convenient. They can call me from bed, from their car, from the office on their lunch break, and they're in their environment, so it's super comfortable for them. And so between the convenience and the comfort and the not having to commute, it's really helpful for them. And obviously, as a therapist, it really increases my quality of life too because I'm not committed to having to stay in any one place and I can travel as much as I want.
Yeah. What's your current day-to-day like?
I live in Lisbon, Portugal. I also have an apartment in Santa Monica, California. My family's there and I can go back in non-COVID times. I can go back whenever I'd like to, but it's been a while. I've been here in Portugal pretty much the whole year. I see clients a couple days a week. And then when I'm not seeing clients, I'm working on some other programs that I have. So I have a wellness program that is basically a low-cost mental health and wellness education program. It's a members-only Facebook group. Plus, I do 2 lives with them every month where I talk about mental health. Every month is a different theme. Like the theme we're doing this month is communication and conflict. And then every week, members get a special worksheet that I've created to help them kind of unpack their relationship with communication and to get to know themselves better. And they also learn skills for how to improve in communication. It's super fun. And I love it because it's for folks who think that therapy is something they're not ready for or they can't afford it. It's very affordable. It's like $20 a month. And then the other thing is I have e-courses that I offer. So I just launched an e-course called DIY Your Brand in a Weekend, which is made for folks who are like me. Like they had no budget and they wanted to create a brand for their business and had no idea who to hire or what to do. And so for me, I like made every single mistake in the book. I learned a ton about branding. And then I partnered with a friend who's a branding professor. And we created this course to help folks who are having the same struggle. So I have e-courses, the wellness membership. And then in my free time, I'm working on a mental health based startup, which is still very early on. But the goal is to help people find therapists faster, which I'm very, very passionate about, obviously.
Oh, that's wow. So much stuff.
I know I threw a lot at you.
No worries. I'm actually curious. First of all, you have your own practice. Was it easy to like start being able to make a living off that already? How did you get your initial client?
There's always a little bit of like a ramping up period. So for anyone that's starting out, you kind of expect that it's going to take you anywhere from 3 to 6 months to fill your practice. And you know that you're going to have to spend some time and energy marketing yourself. For me, I was really fortunate because I started as a psychological assistant. So I worked under someone else's license. They referred clients to me. So they came kind of right into my practice, which was really easy and simple. I didn't have to market myself too much. And then down the road, I partnered with psychiatrists, so people who are prescribing medication, and they would send their clients to me as well to get treated for therapy.
What did you do first in addition to your practice?
So I'm a super multi-passionate person. Through the years, even though I've been working as a therapist for over a decade, I've usually had like some other side career. So at one point I worked for a food tourism company as their director of business development. I worked at a church for a few years, and then I worked for a luxury chocolate company, believe it or not, as their director of sales and marketing. And I just did that because I liked the balance between having this like corporate job or this, you know, startup job, and then getting to see clients also part-time. So I've always kind of worn those hats. It wasn't until 2018, though, that I decided to work for myself completely. So I kept my practice, but decided to invest in some other offerings to help grow my business so that I wouldn't just be reliant on seeing clients one-on-one. So the idea is that these other things are more scalable, right? So you can sell tons of online courses, you can sell tons of subscriptions, and then it would mean that it would free up my schedule so I wouldn't have to see clients one-on-one if I didn't want to.
Hey everyone, just a quick thanks to our sponsor, Obby. Obby is an app I've been working on for almost a year, and I'm excited to announce that it's finally on the app and Play Store. If you're having trouble finding podcast episodes you like, Obby is the ultimate audio buddy for you. It's a podcast matchmaker that learns about you and your interests to give episode recommendations personalized just for you. The best part is that you can play these episodes right from the app. You can find a link to download Obby at heyobby.com.
What's your favorite and least favorite thing about being a therapist?
My favorite thing about being a therapist is that it doesn't feel like work a lot of the time. I mean, there are some days it does, but most of the time I come home and I'm like, I can't believe I got paid for that, you know, because it's just so meaningful when people see change in their lives for the better, or they see health in their families and their relationships, and they see their anxiety reduce, their depression reduce. Those moments are really rewarding. I think of clients where they started off and they were dealing with suicidal thoughts when we first met, and now they're thriving and they're happy and they have dreams that they're, you know, trying to realize for themselves. So seeing that change and feeling like you got to have some small part in that is extremely rewarding. The hardest part about being a therapist, probably the admin. I guess a lot of people probably say this, but running a business is not what you're really taught in grad school. So you have to figure it out on your own a lot of the time. And paperwork, taking notes, all those things are such a drag, because most people who want to be therapists, we don't get into it because we love paperwork and we love admin, right? So there's sometimes a pretty steep learning curve, because unfortunately grad school programs aren't very comprehensive in preparing us for the business side of things.
So you mentioned you don't have the typical therapist path. I'm guessing it's because, one, you do things outside your practice; two, you're remote, unlike most people; and three, you have a pretty strong social media presence. I was wondering how other therapists in the community reacted to that.
I started my social media account in 2018, and to be honest with you, I was petrified. As therapists, we are trained to be invisible, basically. There's this phrase, the blank slate. It's this idea that therapists remain completely neutral so that our clients can feel comfortable to be whoever they are without fear of judgment around us. And up until my time in school, that was very much the case. We were trained how it's professional to keep yourself off of social media and all that sort of stuff. So when I started my Instagram account in 2018, I was so afraid that my peers would judge me. And there's probably a bit of an explanation to why I felt that afraid. One, because of my training, but two, when I started going online with my clients, I got a lot of flack for it. And not always directly. People weren't outright mean, but my colleagues would say things like, oh, that's so great for you, but I could never connect with someone online. It's just not the same, right? Yeah. So I got a little bit of that like shade. I felt convinced that mental health needed to be talked about on social media because it wasn't. And so when I started it in 2018, I looked for other therapists that were all also starting accounts in Instagram, and I could barely find anyone. I mean, there were just very, very few. But I found a small handful of other psychologists, and I reached out and just said, hey, how about if we get together like once a month and we do like our own little mastermind where we can support one another on this platform and kind of share what we've learned and just kind of go in this together. And that was an incredible experience because we all started out, you know, with 5,000 or less followers. And now we've grown communities of upwards of 20, 30, 40,000 in just about 2 years. And what's so exciting about that is during that time, I witnessed the social media world really embrace mental health conversations unlike I'd ever experienced before. Suddenly, everyone was reposting memes about anxiety and depression and talking about these things that just didn't get talked about that much. And so it was so exciting to me to see the stigma around therapy and mental health starting to fade away. And don't get me wrong, it's still out there, but I really think social media has helped so much to open up conversations and give people more permission to feel safe to talk about their mental health and to get help and treatment for their mental health as well. So I would say now there's tons of therapists on Instagram. I'm like one of, you know, thousands and thousands. And I love it. I love that people in the mental health field have started to embrace sharing educational content on social media and making a real difference in people's lives.
Yeah, that's awesome. It's always hard to be the beginning of a trend.
For sure.
You're like, either I'm a trendsetter or I'm completely wrong.
Oh my gosh, I was really thinking that I was going to be in the latter category, that like I was going to get judged and all my colleagues were going to be like, what's this person thinking? I was really afraid people would think I was conceited, like talking about myself being on camera or whatnot. But it's always interesting. People come around. So, you know, at the beginning, I got a lot of judgment about, for example, being an online therapist or social media. And now some of those same people are asking me for advice about how to start their online practices and tips for social media. So I definitely feel like the risk was worth it because it definitely paid off.
I know the pandemic has really affected therapy everywhere. BetterHelp has really taken off. Has it affected your day-to-day at all?
Yes. I would say that this has been the most challenging and exhausting year to be a therapist. And one of the things I've said is that anyone who's a mental health professional in 2020 deserves an award. They really do. Because not only are we helping people navigate their trauma and grief related to COVID and the things going on with racial injustice in the world, you know, those are the two biggest things I think that have happened this year, but there's even more, right? It's an election year. There's just so much that is weighing people down. And there's a lot of beauty in all of that too. But as therapists, this year, we're walking with other people while we're going through it ourselves. We didn't learn in school how to help people through a global pandemic, right? We were never prepared for this. And so it has really been a challenging year just in terms of the emotional burden, I think, of carrying a lot of what our clients are experiencing. And some of them are going through trauma they've never experienced in their entire lives, right? Like mass unemployment, the stress of parenting at home with kids while they're working, fears about contracting a potentially very serious virus. Whoever thought we'd be thinking about these things, you know, 12 months ago. A lot of therapists are inundated with clients. And so that's really challenging because obviously it's great to have a full practice as a therapist, but it really sucks when you know there's people out there who need help and you can't help them. And there's just so much need. And so I think that's tricky. One of the good things though is I've never had more opportunities to be invited to speak at places about mental health. I'm working with a lot of startups and talking about coronavirus grief and anxiety and coping. So I really do think this year has opened up more conversations about mental health than ever before. And that's great for me. I'm just challenged sometimes with making time for everything.
Yeah, because you mentioned a lot about how fulfilling therapy can be and like watching someone really improve. Mm-hmm. Has there ever been just like really struggles where your clients don't seem to be improving or like even getting worse?
It's really hard. Part of what we're trained to do though is obviously we care about our clients, but we don't necessarily allow ourselves to be more burdened by their burdens than they are. So it's about having boundaries and recognizing that we're not 100% responsible for our clients. We are an instrument to their health and healing, but it's not all on us. But it's really hard when clients are stuck or when they're suffering more than they ever have before. And truthfully, a lot of the times I'm not offering them any solutions they haven't already thought of, right? Because there's only so many things you can do in a crisis situation. But it's letting them know they're not alone, letting them know that the pain and the stress they're going through is normal for anyone going through what they're going through, and letting them know that someone cares. And those three things alone are very impactful. And the challenges, you know, they just don't last forever is what I've learned. So even when someone goes through a really low point, it just doesn't last forever. It does eventually lift, or the situation changes, or we learn new ways of coping. And so there's always hope that it can get better.
Yeah. Are there any concerns you had about getting into this field, or you think most students in psychology tend to have before they go in?
You know, I don't know if I had huge concerns because I was so excited about it. But certainly the number one question that comes up is, do you take your work home with you? How do you not feel awful when your clients are depressed all day? Isn't that hard? And I always kind of chuckle when I get that question, because it's totally a valid question. I understand why people think about it, but it's also what we are trained to learn to cope with. And a huge part of being a good therapist is a lot of really good self-care. So therapists go to therapy. Right? Therapists, when they're practicing self-care well, are making sure they're sleeping well and eating well and exercising, making sure they have support from their friends and loved ones. And so that's a huge part of doing our job well, is making sure that we have all the healthy outlets so that we don't get weighed down by the things that come up in our job.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I think that's like with any job, really. Yeah. I'm actually kind of curious, what's the difference between a psychologist and a therapist?
Great question. So there's a couple of different degrees that can allow you to be a type of counselor. A psychiatrist is a physician who goes to medical school. So they're an MD or a DO, and they learn about mental health, but they focus a lot on the prescription of medication. So appointments with psychiatrists are typically, not always, but they're typically like 15 to 30 minute appointments. It's talking about meds, and they will suggest that you see a therapist. Psychologists have the highest level of education when it comes to the different types of people that practice therapy. So we're, as I mentioned, we have like 8 years total of school, 4 years of undergrad, 4 years of grad school. And then you have some other degrees as well that can practice as therapists. So you have MFTs, marriage and family therapists, licensed professional counselors, and social workers. And they have usually a little bit less training, still extremely well-trained, but just their programs are oriented a little bit differently. So it's a program that might be more condensed, like 2 or 3 years. I would say that you can get great treatment from any of those types of therapists. It really just depends on what you're looking for. Is a psychologist who's gone to school more necessarily better than a MFT or a social worker? Not necessarily. I would look more at what their experiences are and also their specialties. So, you know, if you're dealing with panic attacks and you have an option for a MFT that specializes in panic attacks, or a therapist who's more general, I would go for the specialist.
What is the most difficult decision you've had to make to turn your passions into a career?
Not going along with what everybody else is doing. That's really hard, because as human beings, we want to fit in. We want to just follow the pack, I think. And so a lot of the things that I was most passionate about, I hadn't seen other people do them like that necessarily before. And so I didn't have someone to look up to go, okay, well, they've done it, so I'm going to follow in their footsteps and this is okay. A lot of the times I would be that person more on the frontier, the edge of things, or maybe the first or second person to do something that I knew of. And so it's scary being out there all by yourself, right? And you don't have someone necessarily that can tell you, hey, what you're doing is right, what you're doing is good. So I think trusting myself enough to go outside the scope of what had been done before and trust that my intuition about it was right. I think that's helped me the most, because honestly, so many times we just want to do what we think will get us accepted by people. And I have that in me for sure. I love being accepted. I love, you know, feeling like I'm along with everybody else, but it pays to be an outlier. It pays to do things differently than everybody else. And you have to kind of find the confidence within yourself to go out on a limb.
I completely agree.
I think people don't talk about this enough, right? We talk a lot about pursuing dreams. We talk a lot about ambition, especially in American culture, but we don't do a lot of preparing people for how hard it can be and how lonely it can be. And I certainly agree with you. Like, I think being an entrepreneur is one of the most challenging things, because you're not necessarily getting that affirmation and validation that you're doing things right all the time. Because if you're building something new, people might not know, you know, the value of what you're doing, right? If you're forging, if you're breaking new ground, people might not appreciate what you're doing. So yeah, I think anyone that has a dream they're chasing, they know exactly what you're talking about. And it can be some hard days for sure.
Yeah. So that sounds like the best thing you feel like you did for your career. I was wondering, is there any big mistake you felt like you made?
I would say that the thing that has held me back the most is probably caring too much about what other people think. I don't know if that sounds cliche, but it's true. I think I've spent a lot of my life caring a lot about what people think or limiting myself because of voices I had in my head saying, you're not the right person for the job. You don't have what it takes. A lot of like insecurities, imposter syndrome, and the whole thing. If I could magically go back in time, I wish I could inject into my former self the confidence of a person who's been told their whole lives they can do whatever they want and they're gonna succeed. And, you know, like I've heard people joke about this, but like if you've seen the documentaries about the Fyre Festival, I came away from those going, I just need to have white man confidence, man. Like just to go into these situations, like you can't fail, you know? And I just don't even know. My mind can't even wrap itself around like what that feels like. But if I could, I wish I could inject that level of confidence into my previous self, because little did I know back then that I was awesome. And I had a lot going for me. And there was a lot that I could contribute. But I didn't think about that. I thought of all the things I didn't know. And I thought of all the people who were better than me and compared myself a lot. So I would say caring what other people think, comparing, oh my gosh, comparison is,
I have such, it's so bad.
It's the worst. But you know what? It's built into us as humans to compare, because comparing is associated with survival, right? So we go, okay, my neighbor has this, I have this, so I'm okay. But yeah, so much comparison, especially if you're a high achiever, you're always trying to like look around to use it as a gauge for how you're doing.
I used to be like you and be like, yeah, I need like white guy self-confidence. Actually, I felt the same thing when I watched Fyre Festival. But to be honest, I mean, I think that means you lack self-awareness. And actually you end up making a bad product/business, right?
Oh,
so
yeah.
I actually am more on like the Sarah Blakely train. She's the CEO of Spanx.
Yeah, she's great.
Her dad like was like, what did you fail at today? You didn't fail anything? Come back and tell me what you failed at and what you learned from it. And embracing failure. And I really
love that. Oh gosh.
I have still not done.
That is actually so good. I just got goosebumps because fear of failure is something that I think I'm still navigating to this day. I think it's partially why I haven't gotten further with my startup idea, because I'm getting a little bit stuck in perfectionism. And I love what you just said, because I do think if we could let go of the fear of failure or just embrace failure as part of the path to success, I think we would move forward so much faster. So I love that. Yes, absolutely to the Sarah Blakely school of thought. She's such a rock star.
I was wondering, for others who are looking to become a psychologist or therapist, is there any advice you would give them?
You can do it. You know, the first thing I did was think about like all my insecurities, you know, because it just comes up. And being a good therapist is not just inherently inside of someone, you learn it. Right. So if you are willing to put in the effort, you can be a great therapist, and the world needs you. The world needs so much more compassion and empathy. Therapy is such a powerful line of work. And so it's an incredible career, honestly. It's incredible, especially in terms of the opportunities it provides for women. It's one of the highest paying jobs for women in the world. And so I have no regrets about choosing to go into mental health and be a therapist. And I would also encourage them that if they haven't considered being a remote therapist or an online therapist, definitely consider it, because it has done wonders for my well-being just to have this freedom to travel the world and continue to see clients. And so, you know, maybe give yourself permission to explore working in alternative ways, not necessarily just in the traditional brick and mortar office. There's a lot more out there, and there's so many ways to help people and so many people that need help. I would just say you can do it, and good luck.
Oh, that's amazing. Okay, so that's the end of our interview. So we usually give our guests 60 seconds to pitch anything they want. Is there anything you'd like to pitch?
Thanks for asking. Yeah, I'd love to. As I mentioned earlier, I just recently launched my first e-course called DIY Your Brand in a Weekend. And it was made with people in mind who really want to create an amazing brand, but don't have thousands of dollars to pay a branding agency to do it well. So the course is designed to teach you everything you need to know and none of the fluff in literally a weekend. So if you're an entrepreneur, if you're a small business owner, if you're in school and know that you want to build a business, I encourage you to work on your business ideas now, and having the foresight to work on your brand now is such a great idea. So for more information, they can go to exploringtherapy.com.
I hope you enjoyed hearing my conversation with Dr. Therese as much as I enjoyed speaking to her. I love how upfront she is about figuring out how to stop caring so much about what people think of her. Make sure to check out our website, thenewschoolpodcast.com. There you can find links to anything mentioned in the episode in our show notes, and you can suggest amazing guests for the show. We also have a newsletter you should definitely sign up for. It's the ultimate weekly guide to turning your passion into a meaningful career. Get every episode as soon as it drops by subscribing to The New School wherever you get your podcasts. And if you have a minute, we'd love it if you could rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. To stay up to date on all things The New School, follow us on Instagram at The New School Podcast and on Twitter at The New School Pod.
Next week, we have a chat with the wonderful floral designer Chelsea Fuss lined up for you. Chelsea has always been obsessed with flowers to the point where she even grew her own garden when she was just 14 years old. She opened her own flower shop at 23 and her brand took off from there.
Flowers have always been a huge passion. I mean, I would actually call it kind of an obsession. I remember when I was about 6 or 7 years old, my family was living in the countryside in New Hampshire, and I would go out in the rain to pick lilacs with my mom, and just, I can still kind of smell those just wet blossoms and the sensory experience of that. And it really impacted me. And I remember begging my mom to grow flowers instead of vegetables. Could we just grow rows and rows of flowers?
Come back next week to hear how Chelsea built her brand as a floral designer and influencer, the challenges of running a business on your own, and how she teaches floral arranging classes over Zoom. All right, guys, have a great day. Try something new today.
The New School with Christine Hong is produced by Jenny Snyder, Claire Wiley, and Alexia Mersola. Editing by Sydney Salk, John Simpson, and Joseph Cho. Special thanks to our marketing team who help us spread our mission and put the New School name out there. Katie Osaki, Dina Che, Marissa Wolfsheimer, and Giovanni Cortez.